Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's Coronavirus Experts Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone telephone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Please note, this call may be recorded. I'll be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is my pleasure to turn the program over to Mr. Sean Bartlett.
Thank you, and good morning or good afternoon from wherever you're joining. Thanks for getting on this call today. I know we've got journalists from around the world listening in, and it's an extremely busy and uncertain time for all of us. Briefly, I just wanted to say the Center for Global Development is an independent, nonpartisan, and nonprofit organization. We work to reduce global poverty and improve lives through innovative economic research to drive better policy and practice by the world's decision makers. The outbreak and spread of the coronavirus has touched nearly all facets of our work here at CGD, from public health system security and priority setting to refugee and humanitarian matters, to schooling and opportunity for girls, to national economies and the functioning of the very international financial system. So our researchers have snapped too. We've already issued a number of research products and commentary. You can find it right on our homepage at cgdev.org. And much more is forthcoming, and that's why I wanted to get some of these experts on the phone with you guys today to talk about not just increasing testing or flattening the curve or hastening an end to the crisis as soon as possible, but how we'll build back health and economic and social and financial systems once the crisis abates. And so to that end, we have six experts here on the phone who I'll introduce, who will offer 2 to 3 minutes of remarks. And then again, as Leo mentioned, if you want to ask a question of any of them at any time, please press star one and we'll get you into the queue and take your question. So with that, I'll first turn to Amanda Glassman, who's our executive vice president, and she's a senior fellow on our global health team. She has a long career in public health. Before CGD, she was at the Inter-American Development Bank as their head of technical health. Amanda.
Thanks, Sean, and thanks for joining us today. I'll just provide a few reflections on how the international system has responded to this outbreak and what we see as key challenges and priorities going forward. So if you think about how the World Health Organization began to sound the alarm in earnest in January, initially, we saw many countries going their own way, including the United States, either underestimating the response or simply ignoring the advice that was coming out of WHO, the World Health Organization. And I think over time, what we've seen is increasing convergence in the high-income country governments' policy responses, and we now see quite a bit of consistency in terms of following that WHO advice. But when we look to low- and middle-income country governments, we see an enormous heterogeneity. We have extremes like Peru, where they've just put martial law into effect and quarantine, versus Brazil still deciding whether to do something at the societal level, despite an increasing number of cases. So I think it really makes you wonder, how well is WHO working? Are multilateral systems working? Certainly, you know, at core, we failed. We failed as a community in global health and public health, because if there was one thing we were supposed to do, it was to stop transnational spread of these kinds of threats. And it just has not been a priority, despite the fact that the required investment for better preparedness, surveillance, lab, and response had been flagged for many years, and we ourselves, along with many others, had been noting that. I just want to say a little bit about what the different international organizations are doing in response to both the health threat as well as the growing economic consequences of the outbreak. So just to start with the World Health Organization itself, they made a $675 million ask, of which only 37% is still funded. What is going on with that? It's clear that despite they've actually now turned to private sector funding and crowdfunding, so you can give if you want. That is clearly not the vote of confidence that one would like to see for this body that is coordinating the global response. In terms of the international financial institutions, the World Bank has put up the largest commitment in the public domain, still probably inadequate for what is needed. They've offered $12 billion maybe for health measures and $2 billion additional for economic response, in addition to greater flexibility in reprogramming their existing lending. I think all our estimates are that these are totally inadequate. If we look at the regional development banks, the Inter-American Development Bank has put up $2 billion despite the signs that this will require an enormous amount in the region, the Asian Development Bank, $6.5 billion, the African Development Bank, nothing, and the International Monetary Fund, $50 billion in crisis lending. So I think if we look at the scale of the economic costs as well as the direct health consequences, it's totally inadequate. And so the question for us as we start our research program in this area is how much finance should the multilateral development banks be able to put on the table? Right now, we're just talking with congressional staff here in the U.S. to get our routine contributions to the IFIs in place. So we're trying to get U.S. participation in the IMF new arrangements tomorrow, get that in place so that they can do $1 trillion in crisis lending instead of the $50 billion that we see now, that authorizing new financing at the IFIs. All these things are just being negotiated now as part of that big U.S. Congress package, and so we're a bit late to the game. I'd say, just to say, the other big piece that the multilateral development banks need to address is the economic consequences that are associated with the tightening financial conditions, with declining commodity demand and prices, lower tourism, and really importantly, aversion behavior and the consequences of quarantine itself. This has created huge fiscal pressures, and there are huge threats now to human and economic development that would go well beyond the period of quarantine itself if we are going into quarantine in that way. And a big question is, are the same kinds of fairly severe measures that we see in high-income countries, can they even be adopted in low-income country economies where most of the labor sector is informal, meaning they're not on wage employment, they must work to survive? What is it that the global community can say in those countries, and what can we recommend? I think at CGD, and this is the last thing I'll say, we've long worked on these issues of what we call global public bads and goods. And, you know, we don't think these threats go away with COVID-19. There's still the threat of a catastrophic flu, for example, that we wouldn't be able to respond to. And it's clear that our mechanisms, our international financial mechanisms and our international mechanisms for health cooperation are not delivering as they might. So that's an area where we'll continue to hammer and look at further. And I can talk you through the different kinds of work that we're doing when we get into the question and answer section. I'll turn it over now to my colleague, Jeremy Kondike, to tell us a little bit about the U.S. response. Thanks.
Thanks, Amanda. And hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us this morning. I think in the past about 10 days, the overall U.S. government response has shifted from a posture of what I would characterize as inactivity to a posture of reactivity. So up until really the last few weeks, the official line from the U.S. government was that the risk to the country was low, that the situation was under control, and there were no major moves underway to prepare hospitals to ramp up surveillance or to obviously start the kind of social distancing we've seen over the last week. So we are now way, way behind the curve, both figuratively and literally. And one of the big differences you see in how different countries have handled this is that the countries that were proactive, that began triggering measures very quickly after the outbreak arose in China, they have done relatively better. So there was a report last night about South Korea's approach to testing. South Korea began ramping up large-scale testing in their country almost immediately as soon as they saw what was happening in China. And as soon as they saw the first few cases, they went out and began setting up a national large-scale testing infrastructure. We have not seen the same sort of kind of proactive approach here in the United States, and I think we're starting to see the cost of that now. There has been a shift, as I said, from an inactive posture to a reactive posture. So some of the announcements that the president made yesterday about deploying the Navy hospital ships, about activating the Defense Production Act and some of these things. Those are, I think, sensible moves, but they would have been a lot more sensible 3 to 4 weeks ago. We saw, and I think that the hospital ship issue is a nice sort of a nice microcosm of that. The announcement was made that that ship will be deployed, but we learned within an hour or two of that announcement that it will not be deployed for several more weeks because it is in port undergoing undergoing maintenance and preparations and is not in fact ready. So, you know, the nature of this disease, like any novel pandemic, is that the more you wait, the more it will punish you, and the higher the cost, kind of the higher the cost of delay, the longer you delay. And we're beginning to experience that in this country, and I think we're, I think that is the position we will be in now for some time. In terms of a longer-term outlook, what we have seen in China and now in South Korea, perhaps beginning to see in Italy, is that the large-scale social distancing and movement restrictions can play a major role in slowing and reversing the spread of the outbreak, but that comes at enormous economic cost. And so, you know, we are beginning to see that economic cost in our own stock market. The challenge now, so that phase one is bending the curve back down and getting case transmission back down to a somewhat more manageable level. But then, you know, the question will inevitably become what next? And that's where China is right now. They are beginning to tentatively turn their economy back on and see what happens in terms of a spike in cases. We don't fully know yet. South Korea is in a somewhat similar place. And we, you know, hopefully will be back to that place within, it's hard to predict, maybe 2 to 3 months. We will be in a point where China is now. But then we still need to figure out what does that phase look like, because obviously we cannot keep our entire economy and all human mobility in this country in a state of suspended animation for the 18 or more months it will take before a vaccine becomes widely available. What that will look like is still being determined, but I think what is clear from the experiences in China and South Korea is that it's going to have to hinge on a significant expansion of testing, making testing, in effect, universally available. It will have to entail a significant expansion in health system capacity to help the system, help our hospitals and clinics cope with the surge in cases that we are going to see, but also we'll continue to be at risk of seeing until there is a vaccine. So that's a facility issue, but it's also a large workforce issue. And then I think it will need to entail a ramp up in our ability to do contact tracing. Basically, the hard work of tracing down everyone who might be exposed, getting them tested, and then isolating and quarantining them if necessary. That is very hard for us to do at scale in this country, because right now that's something that we need humans to do. We need local public health departments to do that work, and there frankly just aren't enough there aren't enough bodies in those departments to do this at scale. What China and South Korea have done is use very innovative big data tools to do that. They're also quite intrusive. It's not clear yet what that will look like in this country, but I think we need to do a big innovation push on finding a way to do that using big tech tools in this country that are also consistent with our, with our constitution and our way of life here. And I think it can be done, but we've got a lot of work ahead of us to do that. So that's kind of how I see the outlook. We could have been in a much, much better place at this point had we taken seriously the risk from Wuhan, taken seriously the risk of the virus based on what we were seeing in Wuhan in mid-January, but it seems not to have really sunk into our political system or our markets until early March, at which point we had lost a month and a half of possible preparedness.
Thanks, Jeremy. Next up is Calypso Chalkandu. She is the director of our global health program at CGD, and she's a medical doctor by training. She's based in our London office, and she spent years working with national governments, primarily developing countries, helping them strengthen their health systems and do priority setting and decision making. Calypso?
Thank you. Yes, thank you. And thank you for joining us. Three quick points, since my colleagues have already touched on the most of the important issues. First of all, here in the UK, we're seeing much more of a convergence in terms of how the government is responding to the outbreak, convergence with other European countries and also the US, as Jeremy mentioned, there's been a change of tack there. And as we're seeing this, I think it's becoming really important to understand the role of evidence, the underpinning modeling that's very much driving the government's decision-making here, and the way this has been used and communicated. And what we have suggested at CGD is that a broader, more inclusive, more transparent, evidence-informed decision-making process is set up to drive this response, because there's still quite a bit of uncertainty here in relation, for example, to the government's approach to testing. Testing seems to be concentrated on hospitals, people who develop symptoms and present at hospital settings, much less so in a community setting. The narrative is that we're working fast towards developing a test, which would be a serological test, easily administered with quick results, which will allow testing in the community and therefore identifying those of us who've had the disease and have developed some levels of immunity, and having a very targeted approach, getting these people back into the workforce, back into the National Health Service. So that's an interesting approach and sounds promising. We'll see how fast the technology develops and how well the scientific hypothesis regarding immunity development and duration actually pan out. We're also seeing confusion around why we're closing schools down, why has there been a lag in response, et cetera, et cetera. However, all in all, I think it's fair to say that all countries who are faced with this crisis are now converging. The second point to highlight is, as my colleague Amanda said, this is a global crisis, and the net health impact in terms of lives lost or lives that will be lost has to be taken into account. And this is not just the lives that will be lost because of inadequate treatment or detection of the virus to start with, or inability to access intensive care units, but also lives that will be lost because people do not get the emergency care they need because they develop a different condition, go to hospital, there's no beds, there's no doctors to look after them, or cancer patients who are not getting routine follow-up or planned operations. And there's a very real cost in such situations in high-income countries, and even more in low and middle incomes. Let me remind you that Ebola effectively caused twice the number of deaths that it caused. So half of the deaths were Ebola, and the other half, another 11,000 deaths roughly, were because of the redirection in resources and very weak healthcare systems failing their populations. And then there's the third kind of health cost, the cost, so the economic cost and the impact on people's lives, unemployment, growing inequalities. And this is a cost that needs to be discussed openly, quantified and considered right here, right now. It's a cost that developing nations will feel even more harshly than more advanced economies. But we're feeling it, I think, already to some extent, and it's important that this is taken into account. And my third point has to do with product development, which is a really exciting and important space. We're looking at a new test being developed here in the UK to be manufactured also in Africa, in Senegal. And I mentioned, discussed a little bit about that just now. Very important to have that community testing. Issues around producing ventilators. We're asking Rolls-Royce here to repurpose and start producing ventilators for our intensive care units. Vaccine development, of course, the race to incentivize scientists and to get the vaccine out there, to get the capital in to produce the vaccine appropriate quantities as soon as possible. And, of course, the latest findings in China that combination of antiretrovirus seems to be working quite well. And this is important not just because of the research and development interest and the upstream focus, but also because we need to think, as these products, as these technologies are coming out, how much will they cost? Who's going to be putting in orders? We've seen here in Europe President Trump competing over products with Germany, and that didn't go down very well. We've seen also, of course, and we will be seeing competition that's inevitable between high incomes and low and middle income countries, purchasers, and high incomes are most likely to win in that. And again, we need to be cognizant of the health impact of our behavior in the more advanced economies on those poorer countries and their citizens, especially in South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. Thank you.
Thanks, Calypso. Next is Jude Moore, who's our visiting fellow who leads and coordinates our broad base of work focused on Sub-Saharan Africa. Jude was the Minister of Public Works in Liberia and served as a senior advisor to President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf during the Ebola outbreak in his country. Jude?
Thank you, Jeremy. Again, thanks to everybody for being here today. I think the first thing here is that in a lot of ways, across the continent, the response has been what one would have looked for. In places like Uganda, for example, where there has not yet been a single case registered, they've already instituted pretty strict social distancing. In fact, they canceled weddings of 50 persons or more. Now, if the wedding is 10 persons or below, you can go forward with the wedding. In Kenya, I think they registered 3 cases and they shut down schools. And so we're across the region, the travel advisories, the border closures, the kinds of things one would have expected to see elsewhere. And the reason is simple. I think most countries there saw what happened in West Africa during the Ebola outbreak. So in early February, the West Africa Health Organization, because that's the branch of the Economic Community of West African States that deals with health, had a meeting. And what they intend, what they did with the meeting, working with the WHO, was to make broadly available to all of its members the lessons that were learned from Ebola. They're using the Ebola experience to be able to address the response to this. In East Africa, the East African community is slightly different because of the virus, they've had no meetings and they've not coordinated their response. In Southern Africa, with SADC, there was a meeting in early March where they moved into response mode in Southern Africa. So we're seeing on the continent, the problem is first testing. One of the problems we faced in West Africa during the Ebola outbreak was testing. It was taking us between 9 to 12 days to get results back. And in that time, families, sick people were left with their families, and our inability to isolate the sick from the well affected our ability to respond and enhance the spreading of the transmission of the disease. So testing is going to be really, really important. It appears that the number of cases we're seeing across the continent are more a reflection of our ability to test than they are about the true number of cases. And initially, the fear was that Africa's exposure to China, especially because we have over a million Chinese migrants working on the continent, would have been the source of it. But it ended up being Europe, first because of how close Africa is to Europe, but also and the relationships going back to colonial times between Africa and Europe, but also because a significant number of Africans also carry second passports and there's significant back and forth movement between them. So I think testing is going to be really, really important. And so the role of the international communities into helping, WHO has been doing really well to build the testing capabilities of African countries. But the second thing is in most places, especially, for example, Nigeria, they've applied the lessons from Ebola again, and they're doing their best to separate the response to the pandemic from the provision of regular health care, unlike in the West and other places where the health system is slightly more robust. The health systems across the continent, except for a few places in maybe South Africa and in Northern Africa, it's pretty fragile. So as much as they can separate incident response from regular health systems so that people presenting symptoms of the disease are ushered into specialized clinics, specialized areas separate from the health system, it allows the health system to continue to function and not be overwhelmed quickly. What we saw in West Africa was very, very fast and how easily the health system was overwhelmed because as the case loads increased. As of yet, the cases are still in the single digits, except in South Africa and in Egypt, where in South Africa it's double digits and in Egypt it's triple digits. And as long as the numbers remain that way, it looks like the systems are coping. But as we saw in West Africa, as the numbers start to grow, it'll become harder and harder for them. And the economic impact is significantly higher, and that's why I would end. Across West Africa, the country still haven't actually recovered from the economic impact of Ebola. And so there's very little capacity in their systems to adjust to exogenous shocks, including one like this. And for the commodity exporters, the loss of demand is undermining their capacity to be able to find resources. So across the world, we're seeing massive stimulus packages, and I think very few African countries are going to be in a position to use stimulus in that way, especially because for ones that are dependent on oil exports, the price war between South, first the loss of demand because of the coronavirus, and then the price war between Saudi Arabia and Russia is having significant impact on the Nigerias and the Angolas, who had benchmarked their budget at around prices, oil prices of $50, and is now sub 30. So the continent remains, I guess, of all regions of the world, still significantly at risk for both the social and human impact, but of course the economic impact for this. Again, thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Jude. Folks, we've got two more speakers, and then we'll get to your questions. Again, if you want to get in queue, please press star one to get your question in the line. Next is our colleague, Prashant Yadav, who's our visiting fellow and a medical and health supply chain expert with extensive experience across academia, international nonprofits, and even advising some governmental institutions. Prashant?
Thanks, Sean. So what we're seeing is that the global supply chain for diagnostic kits, PPE, other medical supplies, medical equipment, both for healthcare professionals and for patients, is coming under significant strain, both within the U.S. and EU, but also starting to see similar effects in many low- and middle-income countries. On PPE supplies, we are starting to see some glimmers of hope. Supplies are easing up for a couple of reasons. One is the capacity in China is coming back up. There's also significant ramp-up on PPE capacity that we saw in global suppliers. And in some instances, we've seen producers who are not making PPE have switched production lines and started making PPE. So on PPE, things are encouraging. Where the bigger constraints now are in oxygen and respiratory care. And we know that when it comes to allocating scarce capacity, it brings us both the worst and the best in the supply chain. So we have seen order inflation, inventory holding, national stockpiling as common responses across the globe by multiple country governments. And in a scenario like this, fragmenting and holding the market is hurting a very scarce supply situation even more. On the global front, the WHO and the World Economic Forum and the Pandemic Supply Chain Network, which is playing the role of at least ensuring information flow doesn't become a bottleneck, and we try to match demand and supply with good information. What we need is firm orders and volume guarantees for purchases for many of the medical equipment, which can help manufacturers ramp up production to a full three-shift manufacturing versus some of them who are not currently operating in a three-shift manufacturing. The other part which is important to keep in mind is that if any of the repurposed antivirals or other treatments which are currently in the trial, if within the next few weeks or months they start to show strong efficacy and the trial results come out, how do we make sure that we can run a fast response global supply chain to get those products out, not just to US and EU, but to all countries who need them? And there, I think we do have the technical apparatus to run such a fast response supply chain. What we need most importantly is analytics and role coordination things to be set ex ante and made clear so that when we are into a more aggressive infection scenario, decision making about purchasing, financing, how to move stock, what mode of transport to use, all of those decisions can be made quickly. Thank you.
Thanks, Prashant. And finally, Dave Evans is a senior fellow who conducts a range of research for us on education, health, gender, and social safety nets. Prior to CGD, he did this work at the World Bank for years. So Dave, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. So just speaking a bit about the economic impacts and what we're also seeing in terms of education and how that will translate into long-term economic impacts, I think it's important to note that obviously the first concern is the lives of the people affected, but especially in low and middle income countries, a pandemic like this can really quickly translate to erasing the recent gains we've seen in the battle against poverty. A second point is that the first step, definitely not the only step, but the first one in stopping the economic impact is stopping the pandemic, since most of the economic impact comes from people and governments trying to avoid infection. So one of the striking things is that in Africa and Latin America, we're already seeing big economic impacts, even though those regions represent a tiny fraction of global cases, with many countries in both of those regions just having a handful of cases, with a few exceptions, of course. Egypt and Brazil and Ecuador all have more than 100 cases, along with some other countries. What this means is that the direct impact of the virus, so people falling ill and not being able to work in terms of the economy, is very limited in those regions. So these big economic impacts that we're already seeing is really coming from countries and individuals taking action to avoid the spread of infection. And to just give a sense of what those look like, so the latest growth estimates from the Economic Commission for Africa show more than a 40% reduction relative to predictions in growth for 2020. Brazil just lowered its growth forecasts by about 12% for this year. A lot of this comes from disrupted global supply chains, from falling revenues to oil exporters. Travel and tourism has dropped through the floor. Lots of countries, Nigeria, Kenya, South Africa, Ethiopia, have all put major restrictions on international travel. And also a lot of travelers just don't want to travel right now. One of the biggest challenges in low-income countries is that we have big informal economies. So lots of traders and retailers that aren't formally registered, there's no paid time off, there's no sick leave, and so you have a lot of people close to the poverty line, and as travel restrictions go into place and people have less opportunity to move around and conduct that business, we can expect a spike in poverty. In a lot of places, these informal economies rely heavily on women. So in Liberia, more than two-thirds of those small-scale traders are women. And this is where a strong social safety net is really essential to stem this economic impact. So in rich countries, you might do some of this through business loans, but in countries where you have a lot of informal businesses, then what we need is to expand the safety net. I know Brazil announced this week a significant expansion of its major social protection program, Bolsa Familia, and this is a place where the international financial institutions can really provide support in strengthening the safety net across African countries and some Latin American countries. Now, the last point I'll make is that, you know, at this point, 107 countries around the world have implemented nationwide school closures, which affects more than 850 million children. That's almost all of Latin America and much of Africa. So in past crises, including the Ebola outbreak in West Africa in 2014, we've seen that a lot of children don't end up going back to school after lengthy school closures. During the school closures of the Ebola crisis, adolescent pregnancies shot up in Sierra Leone. A lot of those young women didn't make it back to the classroom. And so depending on how long these closures last, the implications for the next generation in terms of investments in education and other areas could be really significant. So these are things we have to keep our eyes on. Thanks.
Dave, thanks very much. We're ready to start taking questions. And as people press star one to get in line, Amanda, did you want to offer any kind of concluding thought or remark to wrap that up as we head into questions?
Just to say that there's an enormous range of issues that this outbreak is affecting, this pandemic. And a lot of it has to do with how we weather the storm really depends on the choices that we make now about handling both the direct health effects as well as the effects on the economies and human development. So we are undertaking a big program of work in this area, and we'd love to stay in touch with all of you as we go forward. Thanks.
Thanks, Amanda. Our first question comes from Rachel Oswald of CQ. Roll call.
Hi, thank you for doing this call. My question is for Jeremy, but also anybody else that wants to jump onto it. Congress earlier in February passed $1.25 billion for assistance to other countries dealing with COVID-19. I wanted to hear from Jeremy how you think about what do you think about the way that funding was allocated, you know, and also the measure required that state and USAID provide within 1 month a plan for how they're going to spend that initial $1.25 billion. So what would you like to see in that plan? And maybe a little bit of what more funding would you like to see in a follow-on response package that Congress would do? Thank you.
Sure, thanks. I can take a swing at that. Yeah, I think the volume of money is a pretty healthy amount to get the ball rolling. The overseas elements of this are going to be absolutely enormous. The risk of the spread of this virus in low-income settings, as you've been hearing about on this call, is pretty considerable, and I think particularly in crisis and humanitarian response settings, you know, thinking about the internally displaced populations in Idlib and northern Syria right now, in Iraq, in Bangladesh, the Rohingya populations in Bangladesh. I mean, you know, there are cases being reported now amongst all of those, and the potential human toll in those kinds of settings is huge, as is the potential human toll in countries that have a high level of HIV, people living with HIV, who will have, you know, compromised immune systems already. So it will take a lot. You know, we have not focused a great deal in the dialogue in this country on the threats to people overseas, but I think that will be need an enormous amount of effort. In terms of how I would want to see that focused, I think there's a lot that the U.S. could do by layering COVID-19-focused interventions into some of our existing global health platforms. So, you know, we have, through like the PEPFAR program, a tremendous reach into numerous countries afflicted with high rates of HIV. That gives us a kind of good base to begin building some of these programs onto. One of the things that we did during the Ebola outbreak in West Africa was identify within our existing development programs in those countries which ones had the potential to be usefully reoriented or repurposed towards the Ebola effort. And I think that, I'm sure, is a conversation that's going on right now within USAID. The other big thing, and this isn't really something that costs a lot of money necessarily.
Small, I think it's a little,
yeah,
a little footnote. This is Amanda.
Please.
I mean, I think one really thing, important thing to say is the choice that the U.S. has between its bilateral assistance through USAID, which is basically tied up in our existing implementing partners, versus the funding that goes through a World Bank or the regional development banks. Because if we want to get money directly to countries fast to be able to scale up, we really do have to use that multilateral channel. So it's a really welcome development to see this $37 million from the Emergency Reserve Fund for 25 countries, but it's in-kind support. For lab, there's some amount of a stockpile that is being shared with some of the poorest countries in the world. But it's technical assistance, it's in-kind support, which is really important, but sometimes you just need that fiscal money into governments themselves. So just to say, what I'd really like to see is the U.S. think both of the bilateral approach, but also the multilateral approach through the IFI. Thanks.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. There will need to be a massive, in the same way that we're looking at massive economic support in this country to mitigate what is certain to be a recession. I mean, that we're going to see the same dynamic overseas. So, yeah, many, many international priorities. One other that is more diplomatic in nature and which is not getting nearly the focus it needs at this point is how we're going to share things like limited PPE supplies, limited supply of vaccines when and if those become available, and limited supplies of new treatments. The manufacturing capacity globally to produce those things is limited, and we're not going to suddenly see 7 billion doses of a new vaccine pop out simultaneously. So
beginning a diplomatic process now that negotiates how those vaccines will be shared when they are produced, I think is quite important to avoiding a real train wreck later.
Thanks, guys. Our next question will come from Sarah Murray of CNN.
Hey, thank you all for doing this call. This question is for Jeremy, although others are welcome to weigh in. The president is still saying that nobody saw this coming, and so I'm curious for your reaction on that. And I'm also curious, since you pointed out that we're behind the curve, if there's anything that here in the U.S. the government could be doing at this point to try to get ahead of the curve, or if that's just not a possibility at this point.
I mean, it is I'm trying to be balanced in my words here. It is absurdly misleading and self-serving to say that no one saw this coming. I think anyone who follows public health matters, frankly, anyone who follows the news, when they saw what was happening in Wuhan, had to ask the obvious question of what would happen if this happened here. And looking at the level of health capacity in Wuhan and in China generally, there was no good reason to think that a virus that could take down a health system in a modern, fairly modern megacity in China would not do the same to a modern megacity in the United States. But going even further back, this has been predicted for years. We have known for years that we were very vulnerable to a major pandemic event. And, it was taken, I think for those of us who served in the government during the Ebola operation, that really left a mark with us and left us very worried / intently focused on the need to better prepare both the United States and the world for that kind of an eventuality. And it was taken so seriously by the Obama administration that in the transition exercises between the incoming and outgoing national security councils, one of the scenarios that we chose to focus on, or that they chose to focus on at the White House, was a pandemic scenario. So I think it underscores the degree to which this has been on the radar screen for a very long time. And I think what we have seen out of the Trump administration is a persistent desire to downplay and to kind of minimize the risk of that, everything from dissolving the health security and biodefense unit, or the so-called pandemic unit that had been set up at the National Security Council after the Ebola outbreak, and that kind of enshrined and institutionalized some of the lessons of that outbreak, but also cutting the CDC, cutting USAID overseas health security programs, and just in general, not taking this seriously as a threat. So I think it's, there is no credible way to say that we didn't see this sort of an event coming, and there's no credible way to say that we didn't think it would do in the U.S. what it did in China. Both are just absurd on their face. And I'm afraid I have to duck out to a congressional briefing now, so I'm going to have to jump off the call with apologies.
Thanks, Jeremy. Folks, we'll get a recording out to all of you after. Our next question is from Jenny Ravello of DevEx.
Hi, yes, thank you for doing this. I think my first question, I have two questions, actually. My first question is for Mr. David Evans. So there are more and more countries implementing community quarantines, and I know this has been touched on in some of the discussions you've made earlier. While the goal is really to contain the spread of the virus, there are societal, economic, and health impacts. I wonder if, are there models that countries can use as guides in implementing this type of quarantines better?
Amanda,
yeah.
Or Clifford, anyone want to take that?
Yeah, thanks, Jenny. I just took a minute for me to unmute myself. Jenny, for that question. It is a big challenge, I think, and I'm happy for others to jump in on sort of on models of what's worked well. Obviously, a lot of this will depend on sort of norms within countries. I think what we have seen is in some parts of China and South Korea, they have been effective at managing this quarantine. I think the real challenge is not just maintaining these community quarantines, but making sure that we have strong safety nets in place as those take place. And that's something that we're going to have to pay really close attention to, especially. So one of the promising things is that a number of African countries and most Latin American countries have moved to electronic delivery of a lot of their safety nets. So this is where, the move to mobile money will, make some of this easier, but it's still a real challenge. In terms of exemplars, I don't know if Amanda or Calypso have examples.
So I'll let Calypso, this is Amanda, chime in, but one, I would say no one is doing this very well at this stage, maybe with you look at South Korea and Singapore, and those are the cases that we would point to, and they've had enormous coverage in the press. But what we haven't seen is what best practice looks like in terms of the attenuation of the economic consequences. And it's been a bit ad hoc in terms of the responses. And I think there's a pretty clear set of guidance that is based on how to handle recession in general, but we probably are going to need to contemporaneously track what is happening. And I think one of the more exciting things about what's happening now is that we are starting to use real-time data on what is happening with jobs and transport and location. And so hopefully we'll have some better sense of who's doing what well while respecting privacy in the next couple of months.
Calypso here. I think that's correct. And I think we're all really experiencing huge uncertainties here. It's not easy to say exactly where we are on the curve. There's no easy answers. Obviously, some people called for a lot more aggressive measures earlier on. Earlier on the outbreak, we were criticizing China for not acting soon enough. Now they have. They seem to have been extremely aggressive. They're reporting zero new cases other than imported cases. However, it's not clear what will happen in the next week or two. As we're expecting to see a rebound, South Korea is already starting to report more cases. And so these are answers to these questions. It's a natural experiment we're experiencing globally, and being able to record exactly what's happening to the extent we can, trust the data, and then observe and draw conclusions and dynamically adjust the response is the key to all of this. So it's not easy right now to understand exactly what is working best, and we don't have the single one recipe for a successful response. There's huge uncertainties ahead.
Thanks, Calypso. Next, we'll go to Jason Bovian of NPR.
I wanted to ask Jude Moore. Two questions. One, where are you sort of most concerned about? And then secondly, my question was about this idea that two of the big things that have been given out by the WHO to deal with this are social distancing and hand washing. And I'm wondering, like, in some informal settlements in Africa and places on the continent, how difficult that would be.
I can skip to here, if I may, just very quickly. I think it's important to have WHO respond clearly, send a clear message out. I think that really matters. But at the same time, blanket recommendations like these are not necessarily going to work, obviously, in different settings. So what does social distancing mean when you live in a slum or in a refugee camp in Syria or in the Greek-Turkish border? What does tracing, test and trace mean when you're part of the informal economy and you're a refugee or illegal migrant? It's not feasible to have these guidelines implemented to the same extent in different settings. And in fact, it's not even clear whether, depending on each country's baseline, as Judith said, for instance, if you have very few cases, or at least you think you have very few cases, do you go full on and aggressively shut down the system? Well, that's a function also of how well you trust your healthcare system, not very much in many countries, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. So you're trying to reduce the implications, but yet again, the economic implications of that, of these kind of aggressive measures are also very important. So it's not clear that these blanket measures can be implemented and or will work in different settings, vastly different settings.
Yeah, everything Calypso said, and for me, two things I'm worried about. First one is testing capability, because what is the point of social distancing if we're not testing? So for example, if we allow families to stay together, which is really, really difficult in an informal economy where people literally have to go out every day as a means of being able to make to feed themselves. But even if it were possible that we kept families together, then it meant the second thing is we're going to begin to see clusters of infection, right? Because infected people staying with their families will begin to infect them. So it's important for us to be able to test first, to be able to get a good handle on the scale of the problem that we have. But secondly, so that we can be able to move to the next step, which would be the isolation. So I'm worried about that. I'm worried about the testing capabilities. I'm also worried about what I mentioned, that a lot of the health systems are already under significant amount of stress. So in West Africa, places like Nigeria, Sierra Leone, Liberia, they see the highest incidence of Lassa fever in the dry season, and we are in the dry season now. So people are going to present symptoms of, in fact, Nigeria is in the process of one of the largest outbreaks of Lassa fever. So we're talking about health systems that are under considerable stress. And my fear is because this outbreak is not localized in Africa, it's happening everywhere in the world, even in countries that previously were donor countries that would provide assistance. It is unclear how much assistance will be forthcoming in case of the outbreak becomes bigger. Because from what we're seeing now, even in Europe, there seems to be some sort of hesitation from the rest of Europe, say, to Serbia, or even I saw a report where Italians were complaining that they hadn't gotten enough support from Europe. So I worry about the amount of assistance that will be available to African countries when the outbreak becomes as big there as it is elsewhere, and I worry about the capability, the testing capability.
Thanks, Jude. Our last question will come from April Zhu.
Hi, this is April reporting for The New Humanitarian. And my question actually piggybacks quite well on what we were just talking about. I just want to extend this conversation about in which ways African countries' responses diverge from those of other countries. We spoke about testing, and Jude just spoke about quarantine and how to do that in places where people live close together. But pushing that a bit further, can you talk a bit more about information, misinformation? For example, here in Nairobi, where I am, the response has been quite centralized. It's been pretty much direct messaging from the Ministry of Health, from the central government. And you had this case earlier this week where a man was killed after being assaulted by people who had claimed that he was infected. Which countries are doing a good job of sort of actively going out, perhaps learning from the Ebola response of 2014, sort of working at different levels, not only central but locally? Can you just speak a bit more about the other ways in which African countries' responses diverge in this aspect?
So I'll respond quickly, and then I'll let my colleagues add to that. So if I were going to add a third thing that I'm concerned about, is that because in the beginning stages of the Ebola outbreak, we ran into a similar problem where, because of poor communication, health workers were attacked in parts of Guinea, in parts of Liberia, because somehow people associated their arrival with the arrival of the disease. And so one of the things that happened, and again, the fear is that in countries that haven't experienced this, the learning curve will be similar to what it was. The hope is that in sharing the experiences of the West African outbreak, that the learning curve isn't as steep, that people will be able to pick up much quickly. By even though it's really important that there is a singular central guidance in terms of what people are hearing, especially in these times where through WhatsApp messages, all kinds of rumors get spread, by having people trust spread. So one of the things that happened in West Africa was because in a lot of instances, the government wasn't the most credible. In certain communities, the government itself wasn't the most credible source of information. The government then used people, other repositories of trust, imams, pastors, bishops, traditional leaders to be able to get the message. And once we got those people who were trusted in their communities on board, it helped in terms of mitigating people's fears. It helped disseminate information appropriately. So I think that experience, and because it's not shared everywhere, I think it's going to be more useful in places where it's already happening, in places where people copy it. I think that's where we see some divergence from how it's been done. So if you use the U.S., for example, messaging hasn't come from some central guidance. States have been doing things. Cities have been doing things. In fact, Richard Maddow had a program where 7 states have actually done nothing. And so because of that, you had this disaggregated thing, whereas in Africa and places, there is a more centralized response. It comes with its own weaknesses, but it's significantly better than having provinces and towns and doing that. I hope I answered the question in some way.
Thank you. At this time, we'll wrap up. I really appreciate people dedicating the time at a really busy time for all of us. I'll make sure that I circulate a recording of the remarks, and I believe a transcript will come a little bit after that, but I'll make sure you guys get this audio with some time markers so you have it. Thank you again, and take care.